It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll get a preview of the upcoming Supreme Court election here in Wisconsin.
First, the latest population estimates by the U.S. Census Bureau show that almost half of Wisconsin's counties are facing population decline.
While Wisconsin's overall population grew by 0.25% last year, the census figures indicate that 35 counties in the state, and most of them in rural areas, are seeing a loss of residents.
Joining us now for analysis is Catherine Curtis, Associate Professor of Community and Environmental Sociology and Director of the UW-Madison's Applied Population Laboratory. Catherine, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks very much. For having me.
So 35 counties in Wisconsin seeing population decline in 2014. How significant is that?
Well, it's fairly significant, but not necessarily a new trend. In fact, when these annual estimates come out, we always think about them within a broader trend. And so the data that were released recently have to do with one particular year. And we generally think about things demographically as far as longer time trends, so thinking about 3 years or 4 year horizons or even beyond, like 10 year horizons. That said, these are incredibly valuable data in that they give us insight into those longer trends, and then they also break down the particular components of change that are underlying overall loss or overall gains.
So you said incredibly significant. Why is that?
Well, these data are incredibly significant.
Right, that 35 counties have lost people.
Well, because there's a lot going on behind that as far as the different causes and consequences of population change, and particularly what is driving change, it matters as far as thinking about implications. So, for example, when I think about these, it's typically migration is a major driver of population change within the United States, and it's something that we see on the national scale, but it has huge implications for local areas, including particular communities within Wisconsin. And I can share with you a little bit about what we generally see at the national level.
Well, let's talk about that, but maybe first let's talk a little bit about where in Wisconsin counties are losing population.
Yeah. Yeah, in general, we see, it's kind of consistent with natural trends, quite frankly, and that large metropolitan areas and rural areas tend to lose populations throughout migration, whereas suburban areas tend to gain populations through in-migration. And then there's always the dimension of overall balance between fertility and mortality, which we call natural increase or natural decrease. And so within Wisconsin, much like within the nation, we're seeing most of the loss in rural counties, particularly in the North Woods, where the rural areas are centrally located. But then we're also seeing some loss in other places. However, this is where the larger trend comes into play. So Milwaukee, for example, is a large metro area which experienced loss in this most recent year. But when looking back on a four-year time horizon, we actually see that Milwaukee had the second highest numeric growth in the state, which was following Dane County. And Dane County is a metropolitan area as well. It's kind of what we consider recession-proof in the sense that it's a magnet for people of all ages, again, having to do with these migration dynamics. But getting back to Milwaukee, over the past 4 years, we actually saw this growth. And even though the last period had this slower growth, and possibly through out-migration, again, that's the benefit of these data. It's not just gains or losses, but particularly how these gains or losses are being experienced.
Do we know anything about, one big question, why people might be leaving? Or is this just strictly a look at the numbers, ins and outs?
Yeah, well, it gives us some insight. You know, these data don't permit us to identify the particular causal factors. But in general terms, we know that population responses or population behaviors tend to respond to economics. So when we think about what happened in Milwaukee over the last year, I mean, it's difficult to talk about it in a particular year. But one example is thinking about, is this a new trend or part of an older trend where we're seeing economic contraction, which means job losses, right? So if a place is experiencing job losses, either there needs to be a relocation to jobs within that area or a relocation to jobs elsewhere. Is kind of an oversimplified but general way of thinking about it. Another thing that can be happening with these large metropolitan areas and is part of Milwaukee County's experience is suburban growth. And so what we are seeing is neighboring counties like Waukesha, Washington, Ozaukee counties, they show a fairly steady growth over the four-year period, including the most recent period, through both in-migration, right, so part of that migration story, but then also that natural increase or decrease part of the story, which is to say that, in general, it's people who are in age groups that are starting families or growing families that are interested in moving to more suburban areas. So it's that movement of people and then the reproductive behaviors of those people.
Well, we're talking about some new population numbers for Wisconsin right now with Catherine Curtis from the UW-Madison. And to look at Milwaukee again, it sounds as though the modest increase was based purely on births and deaths this time around. What does that tell you?
Yeah, what that tells me, again, is it's difficult for me to speak to the specific year. and so it tells me that it might be part of a new trend or it's part of a larger trend. And so, again, I think that putting it in the four-year time horizons. But what that can mean is when we see fertility outweighing mortality, that's usually an indication of a particular age structure, right? So a younger population, because it's the younger population that pretty much reproduces itself as opposed to the older population. And that dynamic is really part of what's happening in rural America and rural Wisconsin.
And you mentioned the national trends. Can you put this into perspective for us about how Wisconsin stacks up with these numbers against national trends?
Well, it's not so much the numbers that we think about. Again, I think it's the trends as opposed to the specific numbers, if that makes any sense. And I don't want to get too weighed down by the data and how these estimates are derived, but there is, in essence, error around each of the estimates, all estimates. And that's where, as a demographer, we tend to think about things, again, on a larger time horizon and put individual year or annual data into a trend so we can see how things are going. So we don't put a whole lot of stock into the specific estimate itself, so much as we do the trend and then how things are ranking relative to one another. How is Wisconsin ranking relative to the nation? It's okay. It's doing okay.
And Wisconsin as a whole, if you look up the net gains, net losses of people, what do we know about how Wisconsin looks right now as a whole?
As a whole? I tend not to think about it as a whole. Quite frankly, it's difficult for me to think about it because Wisconsin is really comprised of many different types of places and many different types of communities. And one of the ways that we cut them is according to this large metropolitan type of place, a suburban type of place, and then rural types of places. And even within all of these, there are differences. So it's difficult to think about an overall trend for me as opposed to what's going on underneath of the surface. And even in rural communities, rural areas within Wisconsin, there are different types of rural places. There are those that are more historically farming and currently farming or agricultural dependent, and they have a different feel and a different history and even a different estimate right now as compared to places that are more recreational or amenity rural areas, and then rural manufacturing areas, they're a little different from the amenity and possibly different from the agricultural communities, again, largely depending on what's happening within those industrial sectors.
So going back to that number again, 35 counties in Wisconsin facing population declines, most of them rural, a lot of them in the northern part of the state. Is that something that we're also seeing at the national level, people leaving rural counties?
Yes. Yeah, that is part of a national trend. And again, it has to do with, there are two things going on there, and one of them has to do with out-migration as opposed to gains through in-migration, and then sort of this double whammy of that out-migration paired with an older population, because it's the out-migration of the younger population, which is typically experienced in rural areas. So as those types of communities are losing younger populations, older folks are staying there and aging in place, and what that does to the natural increase or decrease side of the equation of population change is that you have a population that is of higher risk of mortality, right, or experiencing death as opposed to reproducing through fertility. So a lot of what's happening in rural communities is that double whammy of out-migration of young, leaving an older population that is not in a demographic state of its life course able to reproduce itself, but
right,
is in fact more likely to engage in mortality.
That's of obvious concern to communities who want to keep younger people there to care for the infrastructure, bring in jobs, reproduce, all of that, and keep the community vital. So
yeah.
I guess, is this something that Wisconsin should be concerned about?
Yeah. And again, to put it in a time horizon, we're talking about the 35 counties this go around. Over the last 4 years, the value has actually ranged from 27 to 42 of our 72 counties were losing populations. And again, there tends to be this trend involved of who is losing and who is gaining, and there's not a whole lot of erratic change annually, but again, part of more of a steady process. And yeah, we should be concerned. There are many implications. You mentioned infrastructure investments. That's one of them. When thinking about economic development, it's really hard to think about it when the labor force or the working age population is not there. We think about it also in purely demographic terms, the ability to reproduce, right? So if the young population is leaving and an older population is staying, that is, again, not a population that is really engaging in reproductive behaviors. And at the same time, it's a population that is increasingly in need of support, right? An aging population. So some of the things that we hear about and read about are physician shortages, right? These things matter. On the other end of the age distribution, we think about in school enrollments. And if we're not having a young population, a school-age population in a community, this means something for the ability to schools' doors to stay open. And so this is the issue of school consolidation that is in a lot of communities, facing a lot of communities in Wisconsin. And then another thing that I think that isn't necessarily always on the front of the brain but is there has to do with civic engagement. As well as government participation, who's left in the communities to keep the civic society engaged, active, and who's left to represent that particular community.
And we leave it there. Catherine, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
That was Catherine Curtis, Associate Professor of Community and Environmental Sociology and Director of the Applied Population Laboratory at UW-Madison.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert.
Election Day is right around the corner once again here in Wisconsin. The spring election takes place in about a week and a half. The big statewide race, Supreme Court. The election pits incumbent Justice Ann Walsh Bradley against Rock County Circuit Judge James Daly.
Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television are teaming up tonight to bring you a debate between the two candidates. Coverage starts right here on the Ideas Network or your local WPT station at 7 o'clock.
Joining us now with a look at the race is Joe Heim, professor of political science at UW-La Crosse. Joe, welcome back to the show.
Well, it's great to be here. Thanks.
So once upon a time, these Supreme Court elections would come and go. We would, you know, some of us would vote. It wasn't a big deal. That hasn't been the case the last bunch of elections. They've become a big deal. They've become more significant. Why do you think that is?
Well, it's part of it is just the stakes in terms of the makeup of the court being more liberal, more conservative. Part of it is an acknowledgement that courts in general have become more important in the political process. And as a result, maybe of that, partly because the political parties and the liberal and conservative sides of those parties have become more actively involved. So, for example, the business community or the labor community have become more involved with the elections as general. So they politicize them, to be blunt. And that's increased both the visibility of the races, but also made them more contentious.
Yeah, it seems like Civics 101 now in Wisconsin is it goes through the legislature, it gets signed by the governor, and then it goes through the courts. Like, if it's at all controversial, there's going to be some kind of court element, union laws and things like that. I don't know if we have numbers, but does that seem more common to you than it used to be?
It seems like it is. I think there was a time when there was not an automatic step, well, we're going to the courts with this. And it seems like maybe because of the contentious nature of some of the things that have occurred in the last 5, 6, 7 years, that the courts are the next step. And maybe it's a matter of having the money to do it. But in the past, that was not just the normal step. You would have a law passed, and you know there are winners and losers. Now it seems as if the losers go to court and figure that's one more step, then maybe they can delay something or block it. Some of the issues, I won't mention any names right now, but some of the issues that have been in the courts the last few years have been previously decided by the U.S. Supreme Court, and you wondered why they were taking it into court. Well, it's become it's part of the process. And it's nothing that delays things for a year or two, and maybe you hope for lightning to strike. But clearly the courts have become more involved, and unfortunately it also makes them more politically involved as well. And you now have the, you know, like the liberal wing and the conservative wing and the swing voters. all of which looks like almost a version of a small legislature.
Yeah, in this race, as with a bunch of previous races, one candidate is viewed as the liberal or Democratic candidate. The other one's the conservative Republican candidate. And even though this is officially a nonpartisan race and the judges have to act as though they're not really part of one wing or the other, does that make it hard for the candidates in this race to dance around that?
Yes, it does. Ann Walsh Bradley especially is trying to play a nonpartisan role in talking about not partisan, turning this into a partisan acrimonious type of a situation. James Daly, partly because I don't think he has a large contingent of supporters, needed to rely on somebody to help circulate nomination papers. You know, you have to have a certain number of signatures, and he relied on the Republican Party to do that. Maybe that was intended all along, but he needed help, and the result of that was about a $7,000 in-kind contribution from the Republican Party, which immediately places him in the Republican side. The issues, of course, between the two of them have become more clearly liberal and conservative, and that's sort of the way the elections in recent years have been coming down as well.
Talking to political scientist Joe Heim about the ongoing Supreme Court race here in Wisconsin. Big debate tonight at 7. One issue, Joe, that seems to come up anytime we have a court race, especially a state Supreme Court race, is accusations. One side or the other is soft on crime or soft on criminals or sentencing, things like that. But when it comes to the actual job the Supreme Court does, how big a deal is crime?
A quick answer is not much. There is very little involved, especially with criminal crime, criminal stuff. Most of the stuff that they get is not related to the criminal justice side of the things. But yet that's who's tougher on crime. What I find rather fascinating is that when you have Supreme Court justices and you have, in the case of Ann Walsh Bradley, she was a circuit court judge prior to that, and you have Judge James Daly, who's a Rock County judge with about 20 years or so. They have made a lot of decisions over those years. And, of course, what this results in is opposition research, shall we say, where you go back and look at their record and try to find places where they appear to be soft on crime. And, of course, that simplifies oftentimes very complex cases where you pick out one and say, well, this is an indication that she was soft on crime or he was soft on crime because he or she ruled in favor of the defendant or in favor of the defendant against victims and things of that sort. I noticed that in the case of James Daly, his people actually went back and found a 1992 decision that Ann Walsh Bradley did while she was in circuit court to suggest that she was soft on particular types of criminals. In the same vein, I saw a report last week of a number of decisions that Daly did that you could argue whether they were stronger on crime or softer on crime. So it kind of tells you that that's the name of the game. You try to pull that type of stuff out. The reality is these are not the important issues in a campaign of this sort.
So what is a voter to do? We elect Supreme Court justices in the states. These crime things, probably a distraction. If we want to get away from the partisanship, how can a voter intelligently weigh Supreme Court candidate one against the other?
And the answer is with difficulty. My own suggestion to people is to talk to your fellow lawyers, talk to people that know the law, talk to judges if you're familiar with them. And try to determine what their reputation is, whether they are considered a good judge, whether they have a reputation for judicial temperament, whatever that means. I mean, most of us don't know what that means, but lawyers do and other judges do. So you rely on expert advice and suggestions on people who presumably keep track of this. In the case of newspapers, sometimes editorials can be helpful. You know, they'll interview, for example, both candidates and then sometimes endorse. So sometimes endorsements in this case are very important. In the case of Bradley and Daly, both of them obviously are promoting the fact that they're being supported by either former judges or active judges or district attorneys or sheriffs. So you tend to look at that a little bit as well. But most people find themselves a little bit out of water when you try to figure out who the better candidate is. And sometimes, frankly, we rely on spurious issues about are they tougher on crime or not tougher on crime, which most of the time is not really a factor in these races, should not be a factor in these races.
We've seen some big money state Supreme Court races in the past. Do you think this one, when we run up to Election Day, is going to get real hot with the campaign outside donations and outside groups getting involved?
So far, I know the last reporting period, I believe that Ann Welch Bradley had approximately, $250,000. I think it was a little bit more than that. But I think the Daley campaign had, under $70,000 or so. That tells me that at least within the campaigns themselves, the large amounts of money have not flown into the races so far. I'm watching, obviously, like everybody else. You can kind of tell whether or not the big money is getting into the race by advertising. If you start to see advertising on radio or TV by third parties, that's usually an indication that they think things are close enough that it's worthwhile. In this particular case, I've not seen that so far. Like WMC oftentimes has gotten involved in these. I have not seen any great activity. Early on, there was an issue. As you probably know, the court is, you could argue whether it's four conservatives, two liberals, and one swing vote. That would be Patrick Crooks, mm-hmm. or it's 4-3. But in any event, it's four conservatives, three liberals. And so it really means the conservative side can usually win most cases that appear ideological.
Gotcha. Joe, thanks a lot for joining us. That was Joe Heim with UW La Crosse. More info on this race, tune into the debate tonight at 7 here on the Ideas Network.
I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. It's time for Food Friday. This week, we're digging into the world of soul food. Our next guest wanted to put a healthier spin on a style of cuisine that meant so much to the generations of family that came before her.
That led her back to some of her family's stories and recipes, honoring traditional, replacing some of the less healthy ingredients. The result is a new book that's not only a collection of recipes, but stories of her family and how food connected them through the generations.
Caroline Randall-Williams is with us now. She's a poet, a cook, and co-author of the new book Soul Food Love, Healthy Recipes Inspired by 100 Years of Cooking in a Black Family. Caroline, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me. I'm thrilled to be with you this afternoon.
Now, you say that there's a truth about soul food that we overlook a lot of the time, that the foods we think of as soul foods aren't really the ones that previous generations of families were actually eating day in and day out. They're more like the celebration foods that have gotten the big marquee attention over time. How did that come to be?
Well, I think that there's a lot of things that happen. You know, if you think about something like fried chicken, which is like one of the first foods that pops in your head when you think of traditional soul food these days, fried chicken is something that takes a long time to cook. You have to be standing at the stove to attend to it the whole time. And a lot of families, you know, coming up in the American South and African-American families and, you know, poor white families as well, they couldn't have always afforded all that extra flour with which to bread the chicken and all of that. So when I'm thinking about how, you know, things like fried chicken or candied yams, when sugar used to be such a luxury, became what we think of as soul food, I'm thinking about, you know, the rise of the large-scale supermarket, the rise of fast food chains that claim to sell soul food and that kind of thing. And then slowly these sort of delicious, super unhealthy foods started to replace the things that people were using to sustain them day in and day out. You know, in my grandmother and great-grandmother and all the way even back past that in their generations.
So as you say, soul food, what leaps to mind a lot of times is the unhealthier stuff. You're going back into the history there, broadening the definition. What should we think of? What would you like us to think of, Caroline, when we think of soul food?
I love that question. When you think about soul food, what I want you to think about are the sort of elemental ingredients that are at the heart of, you know, because soul food, you know, it has its roots going all the way back to Africa, all the way back to what, you know, enslaved Africans were bringing to the States. So I want you to think of the sweet potato, you know, like a baked sweet potato for breakfast or lunch. I want you to think of greens that have been stewed with lots of spices and peppers. I want you to think about, you know, George Washington Carver, the great black scientist at Tuskegee University, came up with over 300 different things you could do with a peanut. I want you to think about making your own peanut butter. I want you to think about baking fish. You know, one of my favorite stories to tell people when I remind them that fish is maybe the oldest school soul food there is, you know, when you were, say you were working on as a sharecropper in the Jim Crow South, or say you were even all the way back into slavery days, whoever's land you were working on, that man who owned that land, he might know how many cows he had or how many pigs he had or how many chickens he had, but he surely didn't know how many fish were swimming in his ponds and streams. So a fish was something you could catch and feed your family and celebrate healthily and in the privacy of your own home, in the dark, in secret, in a way that was that kept you out of danger but kept your body sustained. So, again, sweet potatoes, peanuts, fish, greens, the old school foods.
Now, this book was kind of a family affair for you in lots of ways. You wrote it with your mom, first of all, and then you looked back at generations of women mostly, but some men too, in your families who cooked and how they cooked, what they cooked. What did you find? What did you take away from that history?
Well, my mom and I like to say that essentially the book is a, you know, it's a series of love letters. It's love letters looking to the past. It's love letters to my two great-grandmothers, Dear and Alberta, and to my grandmother, Joan, and a love letter. And my mother has written essentially a love letter to me in her section of the memoir. And then the recipes, even more importantly, are my love letter to my mom because, you know, in writing the cookbook and coming up with these recipes, what I've done is I've said, you know, I respect where we've been and who I come from, and I want to preserve the integrity of, you know, these women's beautiful desire to feed the bodies of their families and, you know, make beautiful homes, and I want to keep that spirit alive, but I want to do it in a way that's good for our bodies as well as our souls. And I really, it's an incredible legacy in writing these memoirs. I've learned so much about my family. I love that you said the men, there are a few men in there too, because Papa, my great-grandfather, he did not like the idea of his wife raising a finger in her kitchen because his mother had actually been a young woman who worked in the kitchen of his father's house. So she was a young black woman. His father was a white man in Selma, Alabama. And so he, having seen his mother work in a kitchen in a way that was really hard for him, he never wanted his black wife to have to do that. So he instead just cooked everything and then let her claim that she cooked it. I think that's a pretty amazing precedent to set as a man who also ran his own business. But it's just those little odds and ends of wonderful family history that, you know, the more I talk about the book out in the world, the more other people hear those stories, they resonate, and I hear all these other family stories told back to me. So it's been an incredible community-building experience, too.
It's Food Friday. We're talking with Caroline Randall Williams, co-author of Soul Food Love. She's putting a healthier spin on what we think of as soul food. And Caroline, you've mentioned already you're trying to make a healthier take on soul food. Another thing I love about the cookbook is you're trying to make it with readily available ingredients. If all you have is a, you know, department store with a grocery section in it, you can still find the ingredients here. Why was that important to you?
Oh, God, because I think one of the biggest crises in this country in terms of the, you know, the obesity epidemic and all of that is the fact that a lot of people that are struggling with their weight are struggling because they live in food deserts. And I think that there are so many cookbooks where the sort of subtext is, but if you can't shop organically and you can't, you know, farm fresh all of this and you know, grass fed all of that, then you might as well not bother. And I really think that it's slow and steady wins the race. We like to say the struggle is real, but the joy is too. So I want people to feel like they can go into any food place that they have access to and make something that's delicious and good for them, and not feel defeated before they even walk into the grocery store.
Well, let's get into some of the recipes now. Greens are a staple of soul food, and a whole lot of things are versatile. What do you like to do with greens? It's a simple treatment that's going to taste good.
Well, in my book, I have a recipe that calls for a mess of greens, and I don't stipulate explicitly. You know, I do in my recipe. I say, you know, a mix of all of these, but I really encourage people when they come to my book to sort of riff on it however they'd like, you know, sort of like a jazz approach to my recipes, in the sense that I want people, my grandmother's best friend, who's still alive and who I see often, Gobami Lee, she'll see some dandelion greens and just snatch them up and throw them in the pot with the mustards and the collards and the kale, because all of these greens have wonderful complex flavors, and they really are fun when you put them all together. And I like to make my greens, instead of using, you know, fat back or traditional, you know, cuts of meat to flavor the greens, I love to make them spicy. I love to throw in hot sauce. I love to throw in chopped up peppers. I encourage people to roast their peppers before they put them in the greens to get a nice smoky flavor in them. So there's so many ways to add layers of flavor that are not adding calories.
Did I see apple cider vinegar in one of the greens recipes to help?
Absolutely,
boost that flavor?
Absolutely. In my mess of greens, there's the apple cider vinegar, which I think it adds a bite that is so welcome. And you know, greens are a wonderful side dish to like a roasted chicken, and if you have that sort of the bite and the spice of the apple cider vinegar and the hot sauce together with some, like, you know, healthy protein, that becomes a really, really cheerful, tasty, healthy plate.
Does soul food have, I don't know, a particular flavor profile that we can think of when we're putting it together, given that some of it sounds like experimentation and going with what you come across, like those dandelion greens? But do you think of it as having heat and a bite? Is that part of soul food?
I think that certainly in my experience, and, you know, I have on my father's side some Louisiana roots, and also obviously, you know, there's a strong tradition of like hot pepper soup and the utilizing of hot peppers in African cooking too. So I think absolutely heat, any warm spices, you know, cinnamon, nutmeg, that kind of thing. But I also think, I think that, you know, the flavor of the yam and the sweet potato is essential. The flavor of, you know, the skin on a well-roasted chicken, all of those things, and the aromas of a house where, you know, something's going on in the kitchen, so to speak. But I also think that, as much as I say that on the one hand, I also think that I love the idea that soul food is an evolving food, in the same way that what it means to be, you know, an American and a Black American is an evolving existence. You know, and the more wonderful and hybrid our culture becomes, the more wonderful and hybrid I, like, invite the food to be.
We're talking right now with Caroline Randall-Williams about the world of soul food and her quest to put a healthier spin on the cuisine. Her new book is Soul Food Love. We'd like to hear from you, too, at 800-642-1234.
Do you make soul food? And what are some of your go-to recipes, your favorite dishes? And what do you do, if anything, to try to make them that little bit healthier for your family? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll pick up that conversation and check out a recipe we have on the Facebook page, a chicken peanut stew, coming up after a look at the news with Kristen Durst. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're talking with Caroline Randall-Williams, the author of Soul Food Love. And we want to hear from you on this. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you make soul food in your home? Do you have a favorite recipe? And do you try to make it healthy? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Go right to a caller. We've got Boyd on the line in Wautoma. Boyd, hi.
Hey, Rob. Hey, Veronica. It's been a long time since I've called in. Good to hear from you guys. You know, I listen to what your guest says, and, you know, she's really spot on when it comes to soul food, because the stereotype, and I really mean that to the highest degree, we think of as, you know, whether it's, you know, fried chicken and stuff that, you know, is not even, you know, supposed to be healthy. And when you really explore soul food, it isn't that way at all. One book that I have, it's a gentleman out of Oakland, California, called Soul Food Vegan, and he has a lot of the same recipes that the guest talks about. And, you know, some of the things that I like cooking, you know, she mentioned sweet potato. It's taken me a while to get used to sweet potato, but, you know, one thing I would make is a sweet potato hash brown, where you just, you know, you dice it up and then use applesauce to keep it together, and you can, you know, fry it, you know, and grapeseed oil, and that's a really good one. And with April coming around, collard greens. You know, you can cook them in so many ways, and they're healthy, and like I said, with April, they're going to be in season. And I also like African peanut soup. I mean, it's to die for.
Boyd, thank you so much. Getting me hungry, hungrier than I was already. Caroline, you don't avoid meat in the book, but there are a number of vegetable options in your book, aren't there?
Absolutely. And I think that was something that came very naturally. It's sort of, when we were putting the book together, I said, gosh, I look like a vegan or some sort of vegetarian somebody or other. And I really don't have my own personal food restrictions. But you know, when you're really trying to get back to the basics, it is a lot of vegetables. There's a lot of love that comes from things that grow out of the ground, you know. And I thought that was really fun. And it also, very happily, is very authentic to the roots of the foodways.
I want to talk about that recipe that you shared with us, that peanut chicken stew. Can you talk a little bit about what goes into it and how it comes together?
Well, I think it might be my absolute favorite recipe from the book. And it has as its base a recipe that my mother and I came up with together. I came up with it to help my mother in a moment of crisis when we have a sweet potato broth, which is essentially one sweet potato, a bunch of celery, a carrot, an onion, olive oil, and some cloves, and you sort of you cook it all up together until the sweet potatoes go soft, and then you blend it into what we like to call a open quotation marks broth, close quotation marks. And it's a wonderful, really flavorful base. I tend to keep a bunch of it frozen in my freezer at any given time so I can throw soup together. And then it's just delicious. You throw in your chicken breast meat and you throw in some tomatoes, and it just has this, and you put in peanut butter. And I like to home make my peanut butter, which a lot of people don't even know that they can do, but it's easier and cheaper than using the store-bought kind. So I throw in my homemade peanut butter, and the soup is really very easy to assemble. And with all of the spices, and you put in your cayenne and your you put in the cayenne and the cinnamon and all the different, you know, all of the fabulous flavors together, and it's just a beautiful soup, and it's a delicious soup, and it's I was joking with one of my friends the other day that she was surprised I still love it so much, because I'm a full-time graduate student as well, and I made a giant pot of it for myself during finals week this winter, and I ate it for breakfast, lunch, and dinner for, I think, 5 or 6 days. But I never got tired of it because it's that delicious.
This sounds fantastic, and I want I think that's going to be a weekend project to do that broth. I think I still have a sweet potato that needs something being done with it. Back to our callers. Boyd, by the way, thanks for the call. We'll go to Lynn in Coloma now. Lynn, hi.
Hi, I'm Scots-Irish, and this is very interesting to me because, well, we were sent to penal colonies in Georgia, and that's where my family came from. But I think there's a lot of similarities in her cooking to my family's cooking, because we eat greens, we use fatback, we use bacon, we use all this stuff in our cooking, and I think, you know, she could have another cookbook.
Lynn, thank you so much. And Caroline, you mentioned, I think on the air, or at least in your book, that this is not just black people in the South. This is poor white people in the South had similar cuisines.
Oh, absolutely. And I love, you know, my great-grandmother, Alberta Bonton, who we talk about, she's grandma in the cookbook. She was born in Waycross, Georgia, and her father was a white man of Irish descent, incidentally, and her mother was a young woman who worked for his family, and because obviously there's some complicated history there, but there's tons of overlap in the food, of course. And, you know, soul food, American Southern food, is a hybrid food. It's got French influence from the Louisiana. It's got African influence. It's definitely got Irish and English influence as well. And I think that, you know, a lot of the economic struggles and the resource were a lot of the economic struggles were shared between poor white people and poor black people, and a lot of the resources that they did and didn't have were similar. So I think that that's absolutely true, and I love the idea of and hope very much to have a second cookbook, and I would love to explore, you know, that those intersections more.
We're talking about healthy soul food right now with our guest, Caroline Randall-Williams, who wrote the book Soul Food Love with her mom, Alice Randall. And let's talk a little bit about dessert before we have to let you go. You've got some beautiful-looking desserts in there, meringues, and something especially intriguing. You call it chocolate communion. Tell us about that one.
Chocolate communion is it's the easiest and by far the most fun dessert. We, you know, down here in the South, you can find church stores, you know, in any southern town, and so we go to the church store and we buy a big old stack of communion cups, and then we put bourbon in our little bitty communion cups, and then we'll go and get just several bars of delicious dark chocolate. We like here in Nashville the locally made Olive and Sinclair dark chocolate, and we just break up little pieces of dark chocolate and serve them with little communion pieces or communion cups of bourbon. So it's a little bit of the, you know, in communion you have the body and the blood, and in chocolate communion you have the chocolate and the bourbon, which is almost like a secular spiritual experience here in the South. And we like it because it's a little bit of a kick and something delicious, but you know, dark chocolate has health benefits, and a little bit of bourbon, I think, is good for your soul, and a communion cup size can't do too much harm.
Caroline, do the people at the church store know what you're doing with those communion cups?
What is it? He without sin cast the first stone.
Oh, it sounds like they've been put to good use in your family with a lot of love, yeah. That's for sure. Well, before we let you go, any other favorites that you want to leave us with? Something you think we should try at home, maybe?
Oh, well, I would send you, since we're ending on desserts, I'd send you to the crepe stack, which I love because, you know, I was raised with these beautiful, elaborate, you know, my great-grandmother made these gorgeous cakes, and my mother would make me a strawberry cake for my birthday with all these layers. And a crepe stack is, you know, a crepe has tablespoons of flour instead of cups of flour, and then we just layer it like a crepe. And then strawberries, and then the minty yogurt sauce, and then another crepe and strawberries. And you wind up with this beautiful, vibrantly colored stack that you can put on a cake dish and serve, you know, with a lot of ceremony. And it's very beautiful, but it's a very small fraction of the calories of a big cake. And it seems extra special because people don't see things like that as often anymore. So
fantastic.
I would encourage people to try a crepe stack instead of a cake next time they want to bring something fun to a celebration.
Caroline, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me. This has been a blast.
That's Caroline Randall-Williams. She's the co-author of Soul Food Love. The 1990s are coming back to life in the world of pop culture anyway. We heard earlier this week that hit conspiracy TV show The X-Files was coming back for a 6-episode run with the original producer and, of course, Mulder and Scully.
And today we find out that 90s sitcom Coach is coming back, not for a reboot or a remake, but a sequel with star Craig T. Nelson on hand as a now retired college football coach, picking up 18 years after the action of the original series, which ran for 8 years.
So, I don't know, are we hitting, you like the peak phrase, peak nostalgia here? And we're both X-Files, okay.
No, I'm on board with X-Files. That's amazing. But I have to wonder if cumulatively we've run out of ideas for TV shows.
Right. How about a sitcom about a plucky public radio afternoon show? Nah, it'll never fly. Anyhow, speaking of the 1990s, later today a guest will make the case that 1995 was a pivotal year in American history, the year the future was invented. We'll go out with a hit from that year, Real McCoy with Another Night.